years. All right. So this is Chris Kern, and I am here with Lori Foley at the Washington Convention Center in Washington, D.C. She has agreed to be interviewed. This interview is part of the American Library Association Oral History of Library Preservation. This recording will be the property of the American Library Association and may be published and used for scholarly research. Today is June 23rd, 2019. So we can start with your life history. When and where were you born? Where did you grow up? Where have you lived and worked?
Okay, so I was born in San Francisco in 1956. Mm-hmm. My mother was from San Francisco and my father was from Hawaii. So before I was even 1 year old, we moved to Honolulu, where my father had a business or had worked there. And so I grew up in Honolulu. I started actually in Kailua, Oahu, Hawaii. This was pre-zip code days, and this was when phone numbers only had six numbers. And I had submitted some jokes to Golden Magazine when I was a kid, and I got pen pals, and they were only addressed to my name, Kailua, Hawaii, and they made it to me. So I had pen pals from the mainland in the Midwest, which was kind of fun. So I grew up in Kailua and moved to Honolulu in high school and pretty much stayed there until college. And in college, I wanted to see snow falling. I had too many relatives in California, and the East Coast seemed so snotty. So I found a school in Colorado, so I went to Colorado College. Saw snowfall and saw snowmelt, and loved it there, but every time I went over the crest of a hill, I expected to see ocean. So as gorgeous as Colorado is, I needed to be someplace where I could see the ocean. But before I decided that, I had graduated from Colorado College with a degree in humanities for elementary school teachers. Yay, humanities. And decided that I was going to be an elementary school teacher. So I applied to a number of places. But, of course, as a green elementary school teacher, you don't get selected until August, until all the other schools have been placed. So in the meantime, I had always been intrigued by publishing. So I went to the Denver Publishing Institute. So this would be the summer of 1974. And it was there when I heard a presentation by someone from the Book of the Month Club when I said, I'm going to go into publishing. So I had interviewed for a position as an elementary school teacher in a very, very small town whose name I don't even recall, and was offered the job but turned it down and said, I'm sorry, I'm going into publishing. And the principal said, what? And I said, I'm so sorry, but I'm going to go into publishing. And his daughter, the fire chief's daughter, ended up getting the position. So that changed the trajectory of where I would be going forever, because I moved to Boston to go into publishing. New York was a possibility, but not really for me. New York had always seemed so intimidating, and it still seems somewhat intimidating to me. So I decided I would go to Boston and go into publishing there because I had a brother living there at the time. And it was all who you knew, and it just so happened that the man I was dating at the time, who was a Colorado College graduate, also had an uncle who knew someone who was in a class with someone who was a publisher. So long story short, I ended up working for the Atlantic Monthly Press. Timing was everything. I was the assistant to the director of the Atlantic Monthly Press. And so I got my foot in the door in publishing and decided I was going to be an editor. That's what I was going to do when I decided to move to Boston. And seeing how editing worked and the kind of thinking that went into it, I was more intrigued by the production side, the copy editing, proofreading, manufacturing side of it, and design, certainly, of books. So I wasn't there very long and moved on to Houghton Mifflin, a job in the art department. working on commissioning artwork for elementary school textbooks, which was a really fun and fascinating job, having the opportunity to work with artists who have wonderful skills. And the challenge was, we want to have kids that are representative of the current census. We want to have kids that show kids that are disabled. We want them playing with frogs, and the background is a playground, but we have to make sure that the playground equipment is wheelchair accessible, and on and on and on. So it was a challenge to try to get artists to do all of the above, but it was fun. Not something I wanted to do forever, and from there I went to WGBH Boston, which is the public television and radio station in Boston. And in that place, they also had a design studio, and the design director came to Houghton Mifflin one day to show the portfolio and said essentially, we could help you design things. And when I saw that portfolio, I said, I am going to go to work at WGBH. So I ended up applying, and I did get a job there. And it was amazing. I thought, well, maybe I'm going to be a graphic designer instead. But after being in that environment, I realized I didn't have what it takes to be a graphic designer. I was there as a production assistant and primarily as a typesetter. So learned about typography and certainly absorbed a lot of information about design, what's good, what works, what doesn't. And I also met my current husband there. So that was exciting. And from there, I worked on a book. I worked on a number of books. But the one that I worked on that led to the next job was a book on Nova, the program that Nova, a four-color illustrated book with Addison Wesley Publishing Company up in Reading, Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. And worked with a wonderful editor there, Doe Coover. And from there, she hired me away to work on books full-time, which I loved. One of my favorite books that I worked on was The Mary Kay Guide to Beauty, which ended up being on the New York Times bestseller list because all of Mary Kay cosmetics sellers bought copies, multiple copies. And then we went back to press, and then all the books started returning because it had reached essentially a saturation point. But it was really fun. That was a really great experience to see how a company like that operates. So I published worked on a number of books there. And from there, I went to have a baby, whose birthday happens to be today, June 23rd. So I had Ben, my older son, and really loved working, so I didn't want to be a stay-at-home mother. And after 6 months staying at home, I had applied for a job as the director of production and manufacturing at Beacon Press, another publisher in Boston, and got that position. So enjoyed doing that, more production-oriented work, commissioning design and cover art and illustration and printers and manufacturers to work on things. Had a second child, Mike, then Michael, and was really kind of fed up with publishing, asking manufacturers to turn and printers to turn things around faster, better, cheaper. And my knees were getting really calloused, begging, because having to make up all the time that everybody else previously in the cycle, from the author to the editing to the copy editing, all the way through, having to catch up that time, it was really wearing my knees, I guess my skin thin. And my husband suggested that I look into North Bennett Street School, which is a quote-unquote trade school in the north end of Boston. And they have a two-year hand bookbinding program, as well as such amazing programs as carpentry, preservation carpentry, furniture and cabinetry, jewelry making, violin making, piano tuning and technology, locksmithing. I'm sure I'm forgetting some. But that two-year program was just so amazing because you were immersed in an environment where everybody was creating. And the class, there were six benches in the first year and 6 benches in the second year. We ended up having one person had to withdraw before they started, so there were 5 of us in the first year and 6 in the second year. And it made getting up really early and catching the train into Boston all worthwhile, because you lived, breathed, and thought about creating. And in that particular instance, it was books, which was something that I had known for years now. I was in publishing for 15 years. And so knowing how they move, and that was the beauty of it, knowing that they are mechanical instruments that move, and how you can make them move well, and how they are manufactured so they don't work as well, was really exciting. And I was thinking I would hang my shingle outside the door when I graduated, and my husband said, "Are you crazy? We have children who want to go to college." So I ended up, while I was at North Bennett Street School, I was at Harvard University as a casual, which meant that you did grunt work, essentially, but you did work. And I was very fortunate to have a casual position at Houghton Library, the Rare Books and Manuscripts Library at Houghton Library. So that was an amazing experience, to be able to look at and handle and examine books that we had talked about in school in terms of 15th century bindings and just illustration and all sorts of unique values and how they were printed and manufactured isn't the word. So that was a wonderful place to be. And soon after I started working, after I graduated, I got a part-time position at Tazer Library, the anthropology library at Harvard, doing commercial binding, coordinating the commercial binding. And there was a basement room that was filled with junk. And I had been advised once by someone who wisely said, take that room over, just start cleaning it up. They'll love it if you start cleaning it up. And then start putting in benches and start doing work in there, conservation treatment. So eventually was able to take the entire basement room over, was able to get funding to have benches made and to bring some equipment in. And so this was not treatment of rare books, because I wasn't a conservator, but certainly to be able to mend books, box books, get them ready for digitization, if that was what was going to happen to them. And that was a wonderful experience to have, to put something like that together. And then as part of that program, as part of being there, I had the ability to take a course at the Northeast Document Conservation Center, Preservation Management 101, that was recommended to me by Jan Merrill Oldham and Jane Hedberg. And that really was another eye-opening event, to see that preservation, so that was really my first exposure to preservation in a fullest sense of understanding the various facets of preservation. I had actually started working in a library back in 1971. My first real job, other than babysitting, was the summer of my sophomore year in high school. I worked in the Media Resource Center at Punahou School, cleaning 16-millimeter films, booking them for teachers. That's when they had the 35-millimeter films that you clicked on, and then they were shown on the screen. I don't even remember what they're called now. We had records that people could check out, honest-to-goodness vinyl records, 16-millimeter films, books, that accompanied them. So I did that all the way through high school. It was a great job, because it was demanding, because you had to schedule things and get them back from people who were very bad about returning them to the Media Resource Center, but gave me a sense. I mean, looking back at it now, I was doing preservation work. Right back then, I was cleaning film. So I did that. In college, I worked for the college librarian and typed card catalogs, looked through various magazines and placed orders for them, that the librarian had, Dr. Fagan had indicated he wanted there. So I worked there through summers also. And he had suggested that I go to library school. And I said, library school? I don't want to go to library school. and what a mistake that was, but oh well. So I've always been involved in the library angle of things from the technical services side, from the back end, behind closed doors, and loved that whole world and that realm. And so I've been involved with ALA. I don't know whether I joined when I was at Harvard, but I certainly, I may haven't even written down, but I certainly was aware of ALA and all that it offered. Let's see if I have that written down. I was a member from 2001.
2001,
okay. To the present. So from Tozer Library, I ended up going to the Northeast Document Conservation Center. And I worked one summer there in the book lab as a conservation technician, which I loved. And some people really like that satisfaction of having a pile of broken books on your left and then working through the pile and having them repaired and ready for replacement or shelf replacement by the end of the week. And I liked doing that, but I wanted more. I really felt the desire to do more. So at the Northeast Document Conservation Center, I was in field services. That was my first. I was a field service representative. And I started doing that in 2001. And I was a field service representative until 2005. And that job primarily consisted of doing collections assessments, general preservation planning surveys, and the part that I loved the most about that was getting outside, getting to meet real people who had real challenges, just the opportunity to meet with people, try to help them in any way, direct them to resources, and just knowing what was really happening in the field. And the part that I hated was, of course, writing the survey reports, which ended up being in the 30-page category. Some of it was boilerplate, but there was a lot of thinking that had to go into that. And in 2005, I was promoted to become the Director of Preservation Services. So that was a great step forward, and having the ability to manage major grant projects. And I have Ann Russell, who was the director of NEDCC while I was there, have the foresight and ability, the prescience, to be able to say, this is what's going to be on the horizon coming up next. She would just be able to extract that from attending ALA meetings, and I would be sitting in the same meetings that she would be, and we'd come back and discuss what we gleaned, and I was always amazed at what she got out of it, and the meager things that I was able to learn from those meetings. And so one of the many projects that she wrote was one for the disaster plan project, creating a template for disaster planning. It obviously was an issue that, and continues to be an issue, that not just libraries, but museums and archives and other collecting institutions don't have a plan for when the bad happens. And so we had a wonderful IMLS grant to be able to pull together a template for this, and it became an online template referred to as D-Plan. And the idea was NEDCC would support this program, this online program and platform forever, which was a wonderful idea. So there was boilerplate that existed in the background, and the the online template asked questions that were specific to an institution, everything that covered all facets of the emergency management or the disaster planning cycle. So in addition to response and recovery, there were preparedness issues and as well as follow-up issues. What do you do, you know, once you have a disaster plan? So a lot of that activity is template material. It's boilerplate. How you respond to a wet book is often the same. And so that information isn't seen when you're answering the questions, but what really was important and valuable on the part of the person, the institution filling in that template was how do you customize that for your institution? Where, for instance, are the sheets of plastic held? Where are you stashing the caches of recovery materials, response materials, such as buckets and mops and absorbent pads? So that was really great. Again, an opportunity to work with people outside of the typical library community, working with a programmer. And we came up with, we had a wonderful, wonderful team working on that. And we came up with this fabulous online template. And what we learned soon thereafter was that it was so fabulous that very few institutions had the capacity to finish it. The very smallest institutions that we really wanted to help didn't have the resources. They didn't have the staff. They didn't have the time, especially if staff comprised a lot of volunteers or part-time people. And it was quite daunting to get through that disaster plan, D-plan, as it was called. And so we came up a few years later with a variation called D-plan Lite, which was really the basics in terms of response activities that institutions really needed to know, everything from contactless to how do you respond immediately to a disaster. And so working on that really opened my eyes to the world of emergency planning, disaster planning, emergency management. And another project then that resulted from D-Plan was COSTEP, another IMLS-funded grant, which stood for and stands for Coordinated Statewide Emergency Preparedness. And it was a framework that enabled any state to figure out how they can become associated with emergency managers and build from there to have a statewide network that would be able to respond in the event when, not if, a disaster happens. And all this is prefaced by engagement in Alliance for Response, which really was an amazing and continues to be an amazing initiative. So back in 2002, Heritage Preservation received a grant to start working on this concept that was the brilliant brainstorm of Jane Long. And the idea was you've got to build those relationships at the community level, because as emergency managers say, all disasters are local, and you don't want to be exchanging business cards right after a disaster.
Can you talk a little bit about what Heritage Preservation?
Sure. So Heritage Preservation is, or was, I should say, was a private nonprofit based in Washington, D.C., with two programs, essentially two major programs. One was emergency programs, and the other was collections care programs. And Heritage Preservation was responsible for so many amazing things. The 2005 version of the Heritage Health Index on the collections side, and on the emergency program side, worked on developing such amazing projects as the emergency response and salvage wheel, working on the emergency, the field guide to emergency response, and the Heritage Emergency National Task Force, which I can go into in a little bit later. So the idea of this Alliance for Response program really, really resonated, because in order for cultural stewards to have the assistance of emergency managers when a disaster happens. They need to understand each other. And it was very obvious that emergency managers and cultural stewards have different vocabularies. They have different needs, different priorities. And so having the ability to establish this dialogue at the community level, at the local level, really makes a huge difference when something happens to a library or any other collecting institution. And so the Alliance for Response brought together, based on a steering committee that knew the community or the city, brought together cultural stewards and emergency managers for a forum, which was a way for the cultural stewards to share with the emergency managers what their space looks like, what their needs are, why they want to have the ability to return to their facility ASAP because of the need to respond before the mold sets in, for instance. And emergency managers had to underscore the need for their primary goal, which was life safety and life saving, and they were not about to let anybody into a facility if it was structurally compromised or if people didn't know what was happening to, oh my goodness, you mean there are hazardous materials in museums? So in 2002, the Alliance for Response in planning began for the Alliance for Response in Boston. And we were hoping that we would be the very first city to do it, but I believe it was Dallas that beat us to the punch. So in 2003, we held our first Alliance for Response Boston Forum. And it was really great, and it was so typical of the two communities. So the emergency managers spoke, bam, 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 done. Questions? And the cultural stewards waxed and waned poetically about the importance of their collections, and at one point we had to have the hook for one of the local executive directors of an unnamed institution because she was going way like half an hour over her time. So that that really started the growth of and commitment by people both in both communities, heritage, cultural heritage, as well as emergency management. And so Bernie Margolis, who was then the director of the Boston Public Library, said, we can convene meetings at the BPL, which we did starting the following year because the forum was held in the fall of 2003. So for years we convened, and the name of the organization that we came up with was the acronym. Of course, there has to be an acronym. Acronym was CEMT, or Cement, the Cultural Emergency Management Team. And we spent many months spinning our wheels, saying, "If only we had money. If only we had money. This is what we would do." And boy, wouldn't it be great if we could do this, but we don't have the money. We don't have the resources. And it was actually someone from FEMA, the then FEMA regional environmental officer, Jack Sullivan, who said, you've got to stop saying, if only we had money. You either raise the money or you figure out what you can make, how you can make do without funding until you can figure out how to make that happen. So that really opened our eyes, and that really helped contribute to the development of COSTEP, the Coordinated Statewide Emergency Preparedness, figuring out what it was that we wanted to do, turning to federal funding agencies, and looking into foundation grants to be able to make these projects happen. And as with all cultural heritage networks, whether they're at the local level or at the state level, this is a collaboration among like-minded people, both cultural stewards and emergency managers. So there is no funding that accompanies it. This is on top of everyone's job, and is always the case, people who are passionate about something are all in, and they're also very, very busy because they're all in on so many other activities as well. And so what has driven what eventually became CoStep Massachusetts has been the driving power and power is probably the wrong word, the driving passion of two people at the state level, so Gregor Trinkus Randall at the Massachusetts Board of Library Commissioners, the state library agency, and Michael Como of the Massachusetts State Archives. And they have been, up to this year, the co-chairs of CoStep and have really helped make sure that CoStep is there, and we have continued to, and we continue to collaborate with the Massachusetts Emergency Management Agency, because that type of relationship, just like Alliance for Response, is so important to establish a relationship with local emergency managers at the state level. State cultural agencies have to have a relationship with the with their local emergency, with their state emergency management agency. And as a result of that, we were able to come up with a number of programs, many of them just workshops that have been convened, but one that I think we're all very proud of is obtaining funding through FEMA's Hazard Mitigation Grant Program to come up with a framework called Mitigation from Memory, a mitigation framework that can be used at the state level and even at the local level to help these two communities come together and figure out how to include cultural and historic resources in planning and then in response. And so another project that we're all very proud of is the Annex for the Protection of Cultural and Historical Resources. And the annex is to the Commonwealth's Comprehensive Emergency Management Plan. And this was the very first time in any state or territory that such a plan was formalized to acknowledge the fact and to underscore the involvement of the State Emergency Management Agency in the protection of cultural and historic resources when something bad happens. And so maintaining that is always a challenge, but we have such a wonderful advocate for and participant in CoStep Massachusetts from someone in MEMA's planning department who has been with us, and we've told him he could never leave because he is our connection to MEMA. So that has been very rewarding, and we have new leadership there from the Northeast. No, from the Massachusetts Board of Library Commissioners, as well as the Massachusetts Archives. So a new generation of leaders who are bringing new technology thinking, new, social media, ways that we can reach out to people that, isn't simply email. Amazing. So it's really exciting to see this change in leadership, this infusion of new ideas and passion and energy, as those of us who are on the other side are getting closer to retirement than the trajectory, hopefully upward trajectory of a career path. So let's see. So from the Northeast Document Conservation Center, stop me if you want to.
Oh, I just wonder where we are.
I'm kind of all over the place.
No, this has been a wonderful, wonderful review. And I think maybe we could just kind of review the questions at this point and then see if there's anything you wanted to add.
I haven't covered yet. Anything. Okay, sounds good.
Because I think you talked about, and I think you're almost up to the present day. Okay, so except for what you're specifically doing right now.
That sounds good.
Is that fair?
It reminds me of Edith Bunker saying, at 9 o'clock this morning, I did this. So what year am I up to now?
This is fabulous. I'm so happy this is all here. It's wonderful. So the first thing was education and work history, special preservation skills, memberships and organizations. So I think you covered all that. And then how did you first become involved with library preservation work? What was your early training?
and your profession. What organizations were you affiliated with during this part of your career?
So I haven't. Well,
it seems like there are a lot
ALA,
of...
ALA, AIC.
Okay, so the AIC would be something to add.
Would be something to add in there. The New England chapter of the Guild of Book Workers for my bookbinding life. Mm-hmm. I was a trustee of the Essex National Heritage Commission for a while because I was based in Essex County, NEDCC. The Northeast Document Conservation Center is in Andover, Essex County.
Okay. And then you mentioned some of these. Who were your significant mentors and teachers in your early training and career? And who were the first people you worked with? What were the preservation philosophies or approaches that you learned from your early mentors and colleagues? And you talked a little bit about looking ahead and directing you into areas that they felt you would be happy doing.
Right, and I do have to underscore again, Jan Merrill Oldham was just such an inspiration. I didn't work directly with her, but she was there to check in with me. I was at a different library. She would call and say, "What's up? How you doing?" And just her willingness to share advice, guidance, was phenomenal, that she would take interest in someone who was very reluctant to go to library school. And so in addition to her, again, Jane Hedberg, who was also a trustee of or on the advisory board of the Northeast Document Conservation Center. But I first met her also at Harvard as well. She was one of the trainers in NEDCC's preservation management course, who was so insightful, was able to cut to the chase and just say, "This is where it is," or "This is where it isn't," and "What are you trying to do?" And so those were really helpful in shaping the course and changing the trajectory of where I was going. And then, again, of course, it was Ann Russell who started writing writing grants that included DPLAN and other disaster-related activities that made me, I learned so much about grant writing from her, not from any training, but just seeing how she wrote the grants and how she made the case. I really hated writing grants. I still do. But being able to know how to write them and how she was so successful in writing them has made a huge difference. That, as well as participating in grant review panels, where I learned a tremendous amount participating in both NEH and IMLS grant review panels on how well-written grants, what well-written grants look like, what poorly written grants look like, how to make the case, just amazing learning opportunity there, which helped all the way through both at NEDCC and then at when I went to Heritage Preservation, but helped tremendously. Right. And let's see, those are my three biggies.
Okay. So here this was like, what were your original thoughts on or approach to preservation? What were your major projects and accomplishments early on in your career? Dates and times, and you've done a great job of mentioning dates. How was your position connected to the library preservation world?
Mm-hmm. So that's simply the fact that disaster planning is just one facet of the preservation umbrella. And I certainly wasn't thinking that this is my life. I'm committed to doing preservation. It just felt so comfortable and right to me that it was. I just kept going. And having a checkered past from everything from teaching elementary school to spending 15 years in book production and manufacturing, I mean, everything that I've done that's led up to where I am now has served me well in one capacity or another.
Sure. Okay, so your colleagues, and you've talked about some of them.
Mm-hmm.
Would you describe for us a particularly satisfying moment in your later career?
Maybe, I don't know where you are now, or recently, or
late in my career. Well, this is probably
how late it is in your career.
We're closer to the retirement side than the starting. One of the, I think, really great, and this is probably not the right answer to that question. Jane Long, who was Vice President of Emergency Programs at Heritage Preservation. She was thinking of going to, she was planning to, and she was going, she did go to the National Archives as her last stint this field. And she was bemoaning the fact that there was no one who was willing, or that she could think of, who was willing to work to replace her as Vice President of Emergency Programs at Heritage Preservation. And having worked with Heritage Preservation on so many projects, advisory committees, and being engaged in responding, helping to respond following Katrina and other events, I said, I'd love that job. And she said, would you be willing to move to D.C. for that? And I said, well, let me check with my husband. So I had further conversations with the president of Heritage Preservation, Larry Rieger, and he said, figure it out. If this is something that you'd love to do, I could start you as a part-time person in D.C. to start doing this. And so it was a Friday night, and I had candles, and I had wine, and I brought it up at dinner, thinking that I could convince my husband, because the kids were, one was already out of college, and one was just about to be out of college, so we would have been empty nesters. And I said, what do you think about moving to D.C., honey? And he said, I'm not leaving Lincoln. And it's like, oh my gosh, that's like the worst answer that I could possibly hear. So I shared that with Larry Rieger, and he said, well, let's see what we can do. So I actually started part-time working for Heritage Preservation in 2011, and that's probably the most satisfying moment, the fact that I was able to telework to D.C. from home. And I continue to telework to D.C. For my current job at FEMA. And that really helps me focus on what needs to be done. I am not one to just drop my pencil at 5 o'clock or whenever to resume life. So the challenge of working from home, of course, is the work-life balance. But if I don't get out of bed right away, my husband will shake me and say, honey, it's time to get out of bed. It's time to protect our nation's cultural heritage. And I'll leap out of bed. I'm like, you're right. Time to get up. So that's probably very satisfying. Plus the fact that he cooks dinner and says, 5 minutes to dinner. Turn off your computer soon. Yeah.
Oh,
so that's great.
A different philosophy and approach now, later in your career, and how has this philosophy changed over time, or how do you see the future of preservation changing based on your past experience?
I see much of the same types of challenges in terms of getting, specifically collecting institutions as well as arts organizations, better prepared for disasters now that I'm at FEMA. And the focus is on not just response and recovery, but preparedness, seeing that we still, the cultural community still has a very long way to go to being prepared for disasters. And it's always after a disaster where there's a flurry of activity and people recognize, maybe it could happen to me. Maybe that flooding could happen to me. Maybe that tornado could happen to me. But as the disasters recede and people get swept up in their day-to-day activities, no one is usually charged with being responsible for an institution's disaster plan. And so that item on the director's list keeps going farther and farther down, if it's even on the director's list at all. So the challenges include supporting staff who are trying to make the case to their directors that the planning, the time that goes into planning will pay off immeasurably when a disaster happens, not if a disaster happens. And then to support that training within an institution, which includes keeping a disaster plan up to date, but also as people become more knowledgeable, the willingness of institutions to share that information with other institutions in their community, as well as being able to perhaps even respond by providing staff members who are trained in response. And so there's a long way to go. Certainly Alliance for Response is doing more and more to establish that baseline where that connection between emergency managers and cultural stewards starts. But there are so many cities in this country, and so we're chipping away at it. So getting that same thing, and that same thing applies for states. From the federal level, I'm seeing that when disasters occur, states are not prepared. The state cultural agencies aren't necessarily prepared to assist their members or their constituents because they haven't had this conversation across agencies. They're primarily siloed, which is not unusual. Then they certainly don't have a relationship with their state emergency management agency. So I see that as one of my charges, is trying to bring state cultural agencies in touch with their emergency management agency and start having these conversations. And this was one of the programs that was started from the State Heritage Emergency Partnership Program while I was at FAIC, the Foundation for Advancement in Conservation, what it's now called. And seeing this as a charge that should still continue with the growing severity and extent of disasters, it's really incumbent upon states to be more responsible for the recovery of their whole community, which includes the cultural community.
Thank you.
So the other philosophy I have now is trying to engage a new generation of people in this space of disaster planning, emergency preparedness. The crew, those of us who have been doing this for a number of years, we're beginning to retire, and it's really important that I think library schools start making it more mandatory to have disaster planning, emergency preparedness as part of their preservation management curriculum, if there even is a preservation management curriculum. Making sure that federal agencies, I think, and many are moving towards that, and I know some state agencies are as well, to make funding available contingent upon having a disaster plan. I know that some of the federal funding agencies for the cultural community are beginning to think about that, we're not at that point yet where they're saying no disaster plan, no grant. But I think seeing where institutions are and trying to get that support, especially for grants that focus on emergency preparedness, response and recovery, it's vital that the institutions walk the walk and talk the talk.
So are you talking about cultural heritage institutions at the state level? Is that what you're saying?
Institutions at any level,
at any level.
Private nonprofits. So when private nonprofits are applying for federal grants, for instance, from NEH or IMLS or NEA, at some point soon, I hope we're moving toward the point where having a plan is part of the requirements for getting funding, getting considered, getting a proposal submitted. Moving towards that will, I think, really make people think more. I hope it doesn't reduce the number of applications that are submitted. I hope it prompts people to think about that.
Sure. Wow. That's great. Let's see.
us about your service and professional involvement with the preservation community. You alluded to that. You're involved with, obviously, with ALA and PARS.
Mm-hmm.
They mention here IFLA, but there may be other groups that you've been involved with.
Right, right. So now that I'm at FEMA, I'm involved with the International Association of Emergency Managers, or IAEM. I'm on the Public-Private Partnership Caucus. So that entails working, because I'm on the lookout, because I'm there advocating for museums, libraries, archives, private nonprofit entities, I want to make sure that they're involved, or at least I can advocate for them when discussions are being held about how a community recovers, what institutions, companies, as it's usually thought of, what companies are in the mix that we need to make sure can rebound so we can, you know, carry on. And so being a representative of standing up for cultural institutions is really valuable and helpful for me. And being able to introduce emergency managers to the whole concept of cultural resources and collecting institutions, that's something that I enjoy doing. It's not rocket science, but it has simply this concept of cultural institutions need to recover fully in order for a community to recover fully, has not been on the radar screen of emergency managers at the local, state, or even federal level. And so I'm trying constantly to push that concept to make them understand. So when I have the opportunity to speak at emergency management gatherings, such as the Governor's Hurricane Conference, or IAEM, or other even regional conferences, this is what cultural resources are, this is what historical resources are. You've heard of public libraries, you've heard of art museums, but there's a whole world of cultural institutions out there that need to be on your radar and that you can help them be better prepared. Don't wait for them to invite you to their facility for a walkthrough. You know, reach out to them and say, I hear that you have things of value. You know, can I bring the day staff of my fire department to come and do a tour, a walkthrough of the facility? And so constantly raising the visibility of the importance of these collecting institutions is something that I'm doing, which I love to do, because I also get a chance to speak with people that are outside my sphere. Even though I'm at FEMA, I obviously come from a cultural heritage humanities background. And so understanding what their challenges are and what they think about, maybe this isn't such a hard lift anyway. If you, meaning the cultural community, can keep us apprised of what's going on, and you do what you need to do, but you keep us apprised, then we can both go our paths, and you're not making another activity for us to do, because that's the last thing that we want to do, make it seem like they're responsible for yet another activity, which they already have too many to do.
Right. Great. You've talked about many of the projects that you've worked on. You've talked about significant things you've done. Is there anything else you wanted to point out? And number eight, what is your most significant project? And with whom did you work?
One of the things I'm building on now. So I started working...
when did you start working for FEMA?
So I started working in 2011.
Okay.
In 2015.
Okay.
And
you went from Heritage Preservation.
Right. So Heritage Preservation was dissolved in 2015. And so the challenge for that was, as we knew that it was going to be shut down in the year before, was trying to find a resting place for the Heritage Emergency National Task Force, which was one of the responsibilities of the Vice President of Emergency Programs, which I was at Heritage Preservation. It's a statewide I guess it's a federal, I would call it a federal, it's a public-private partnership. And at the time, during my stint at Heritage Preservation, the public part was FEMA and the private part was Heritage Preservation. And HP served as the secretariat. So they pulled meetings together and really tried to keep cultural heritage on the radar screen of just federal entities. And so backing up a bit, back then, Heritage Preservation's work for on the Heritage Emergency National Task Force, that was another responsibility, as I said, of the, being the administrator was a responsibility. But there was no funding, per se, for that position. And so when disasters occurred, everything from Sandy to the present, well, through 2015, we would have to go to the funding agencies where we had existing grants to say, can we spend some of this money assisting the state or states that have been impacted? And the funding agencies would say, yes, of course, you can do that, because there was otherwise there was no additional funding to respond, to help in response efforts. So it made it very difficult to complete the objectives on a grant, and as well as to meet timelines, because when something bad happened, when there was a presidential disaster declaration, everything stopped and efforts had to be focused on helping the state or states, as well as the cultural institutions within those states to provide assistance. And so when Heritage Preservation was, as I would refer to it, circling the drain, we were trying to come up with various relationships and partnerships that would work. And I am happy to say that the Smithsonian Institution stepped up to the plate and recognized, the Smithsonian had been a partner of HENTEF almost from the beginning, if not from the founding of the Heritage Emergency National Task Force in 1995. And so they saw the value of this and said, we can't let this kind of national effort go away. So we looked at various entities within both federal government and the private nonprofits. At the time, there were 42 members, both from the federal agencies and private nonprofit national service organizations. But we are very fortunate that the Smithsonian said, you know, we're spinning up a program. We've been spinning up a program since 2012. Called the Smithsonian Cultural Rescue Initiative, where the focus of that was really bringing response and recovery resources to bear and training as well to the international community, and especially looking at places where culture was at risk of loss or total annihilation or destruction. And it was perceived that HENTEF, as we fondly call it, was a really good fit for SCRI, as SCRI was doing internationally looking out. SCRI could also be looking inward, looking domestically, and providing assistance. And so the changeover with me at FEMA and SCRI taking the co-sponsorship lead with my office at FEMA, the Office of Environmental Planning and Historic Preservation, or OEHP, it's really been a remarkable relationship, and having the resources to be able to move forward in on many fronts, as well as to have people to bounce ideas off of, to come up with wonderful ideas. And since SCRI, since HENTEF has been under the leadership of FEMA and SCRI, we now have 58 members, HENTEF members, 18 federal agencies, and 40 private nonprofit national service organizations. And the whole concept about having members is the ability to disseminate information that I might have in terms of disasters to these entities, who then themselves have either members or constituents, and they can then disseminate that information out to their members and constituents. And conversely, they would be able to gather information from their members and constituents and pass it up through the chain to the Heritage Emergency National Task Force, and then I could share it with the larger FEMA and federal family partnership that's involved in response following a presidential disaster declaration. And so, again, it's what I love about this job is the ability to work not just within FEMA, while I do have to stay in my lane, the ability to work with other wonderful colleagues in federal agencies across the board, as well as to work with state cultural heads, state agency heads, to work with individual, to be able to be helpful to individual cultural institutions if they've been impacted and they want direction. HNTF has no funding, so I can direct them to resources through the membership within HNTF to give them that assistance. And being able to provide technical assistance was a facet of my position at NEDCC that I love doing. Just being able to help was wonderful, and that's certainly, I think, a trait of, that's probably my inner librarian, because librarians love to help. I mean, that's what they're there for. So being able to provide that assistance and direct people to other resources is really, really wonderful, and seeing the results is very rewarding.
Fabulous. So I think you've talked about this, at least from your own point of view, was how much do you feel library preservation professionals are obligated to educate the public about the importance of preservation? It seems like that's what your life has been.
Right, right. With a very narrow focus on disaster planning. But that's the right.
Yeah. And what has been in your involvement with that disaster planning? And that has also been
my
life's work. Are there any significant disaster-related events that affected your career approach to preservation? And you've mentioned some sort of catastrophic events that mm-hmm. that have prompted people to do things. So if there's anything you wanted to add.
So before I was at FEMA, following Hurricane Sandy, I was able to work with someone who was with FEMA, who had once been a museum director, but was now working at FEMA in the Office of Environmental Planning and Historic Preservation, who was deployed to help cultural institutions and historic sites, everything under the cultural and historic resources and historic properties umbrella in New Jersey specifically. And working with him, because I was still at Heritage Preservation, was such an amazing experience, because he brought to light to me my first real exposure to FEMA and how things operate. And I remember saying, not asking him, but a colleague saying, is it possible for me to go to the disaster, the Joint Field Office, which is where FEMA coordinates with many, many partners, both at the state and federal level, into this giant warehouse where all the activity happens in the field, the Joint Field Office, or JFO. And I was told, Lori, you don't want to see how the sausage is made. So I didn't see how the sausage was made, but I was able to work with Alan, and it made it really eye-opening to see what FEMA was able to do and what they weren't able to do. So they would pass newsletters or releases, news releases past me, for which I was grateful that they would ask for my approval. And I would say, I have no idea. I mean, I understand kind of, sort of, what you're talking about, but the layperson, this is all in FEMA jargon, and the layperson will have no clue what you're talking about. So I would put it through the FEMA translator, and out would come something that would be a little more understandable, because the target audience was comprised cultural stewards in the community and who are totally not in tune with the FEMA and should not be in tune with most FEMA acronyms and processes. So that was a real eye-opener. And so I keep that in mind all the time, thinking, is this something, do people understand what it is that we're trying to say, what it is we're trying to convey, or have I started drinking the FEMA Kool-Aid so strongly that I don't even recognize that I'm speaking in FEMA lingo?
Well, there certainly are a lot of acronyms, I must say, and the hierarchy of FEMA was that you described the other day in our meeting Better Networking for Disaster Response was very helpful to put where what you're doing fits within the larger picture.
I'm advocating, as I said earlier, I'm advocating for cultural and historic resources, and just any opportunity. I always say, run any doctrine or policy drafts past me. I'm happy to be up late at night just to make sure that cultural and historic resources are mentioned and their value to a community. So I am happy to do that. And, of course, I try to refrain from copy editing because I was a copy editor as part of my former life. So I try to refrain from changing that to witches and witches to thats and other copy editing things, and just say, here's something that you need to include. Here's a paragraph that I recommend you include because, and then you have to justify why it is. Yeah.
So you've touched on this a bit, but did you want to say anything more about advice you would give to new professionals in the field as you've watched new people come in and turning it over to the new generation?
The new generation. I always encourage people that say, how do I get involved? First, to find out whether there is an Alliance for Response network in their area. And then if there isn't, to reach out to FAIC to see if they have heard any rumblings from others about the possibility of forming a network there. And if there isn't, FAIC, Heritage Preservation, long ago developed resources, and they have since been updated by FAIC on how to convene an Alliance for Response forum, how you start making that dialogue possible. And so encouraging them to get together with some of their colleagues at an institution or at a fellow institution within their community to start talking about that, having that happen. We have traditionally, we meaning the Alliance for Response, have traditionally started with communities that are in high-risk areas. But that doesn't mean that areas that are in the Midwest won't be affected. In Idaho, certainly California was a big one, but wildfires were not as huge an issue as they will be from here on out. So getting young people who, when I speak at conferences, who are thinking, this is really cool, like, pursue it, it's interesting. So any opportunity I get to speak at conferences, I take up. Although this year, I made a note to self, don't write so many session proposals, because I wrote a ton of session proposals, not expecting half of them to be accepted for 2019, and all but one to SAA, of all places. All of them were accepted, so... I have like 14 conference sessions.
So you're busy.
I'm busy, and that's one of the reasons I'm in D.C. now.
Okay.
To present, and again.
Yeah. Well, at least they're all in one place.
Yes.
Do you have any suggestions of other people that we should interview that you haven't heard mentioned before, maybe?
I want to think about that and see.
We haven't given you very much
notice.
That's okay.
Would you prefer that they be in the library world?
Just people who have impacted the preservation world writ large.
Jake Nadal, if you haven't done him yet.
We have not, I don't think. He would be easy to do.
Yes.
Okay.
At the Library of Congress. And let me think more.
Sure.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
Anything else you'd like to add?
No.
Thank you. so much, Lori.
Oh, thank you for thinking of me.
On such short notice.
Thank you for thinking of me.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. From all you said, you clearly have made a huge impact on the world
preservation matron. Holy moly.
Emergency preparedness.
Well, I love what I do, and I appreciate the recognition of this. I'm flattered and humbled.
Thank you.
Thank you.